You are listening to Talk Geek 3 News number 68, recorded for Wednesday, June 6, 2012. You are listening to the Tech Only Hacker Public Radio Edition. To get the full podcast, including political commentary and other controversial topics, please visit www.talkgeek2me.us. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. Thanks for tuning in TGTM News. This is Deep Geek, coming off of a month-long sabbatical. Took the month of May off, and in it I accomplished many things that I needed to do, one of which being a new website. So if you want to go over to www.talkgeektome.us, when you hear this, I will have rolled out the new website, which will have several new features. It brings under my control some functions that I have been performing in other places on the net and will now be performing for myself. This gives me great happiness and more control, and it's all a good thing. So you will notice in the new design that not only is the main page the newscast page, but the links I generate when searching for the news stories for you, dear listeners, are now divided into two pages, two subpages with two individual RSS feeds called News Links and Tech Links. So for those of you who would prefer to follow one or the other, or both, you may subscribe to either or both. And also a combination blog mini blog I'll be doing on my own webpage now. The tab will be there. Unlike regular blogs, I make no guarantee as to my frequency posting there, but it's important for me to have it under my own control. So please check that out. And as this month, the month of June, progresses, I hope to have even a bigger web-serving surprise for listeners of my podcast, especially those who live in the European Union and its neighboring territories. And now, the Tech Roundup. From InTheseTimes.com, dated April 28, 2012, by Kenneth Raposa, radio is about to get better. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is set to increase the number of low-powered FM, LPFM stations after a 12-year hiatus caused by a successful campaign against community radio by the National Association of Broadcasters, a lobby group for major commercial media. Much to the joy of community radio activists, hundreds of new radio stations will pop up in cities across the country, and they will be all owned by you. Want to be your neighborhood's newest block party DJ or run the local equivalent of democracy now? Your window has opened, but not for long. Back in the 70s, most Americans got their glimpse of the inner workings of a radio station from the sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati. WKRP wasn't big money glam. This was Cincy, after all, not L.A. It was down to earth. It was practically grassroots. DJs Johnny Fever and Venus Flytrap interviewed local bands, not the Bee Gees. But just 20 years later, the radio landscape has changed. It is mostly run by large stations like Kiss FM, owned by Clear Channel Communications, and guys who signed the checks of Ryan Seacrest, a radio personality who needs no introduction. Pat Fegala, 29, needs an introduction. She's one-part guitarist from indie rock band Slack Panther, one-part host of Queen City Awesome, which airs Monday and Wednesdays on WVCQ in Cincinnati to 95.7 FM. WVCQ is operated by Media Bridges and is one of the largest LPFM stations within the top 30 media markets. It's helping people in that city connect through the free public airwaves in ways larger cities cannot. I'm not looking for a career in broadcasting or anything, Fegali tells me. WVQC DJs and show hosts are volunteers. They are trained by Media Bridges on how to use a soundboard and run a radio program. I'm into the local music scene, and this show I do with my lead singer, Bree Blisters, gives us a chance to interview local bands. If not for LPFM, there is no way I would have done this, and most of these musicians would not get an opportunity to discuss their music in this format. I don't know where it will lead. I just know we are having a great time. There are about 800 LPFM stations nationwide, small 100-watt stations with a reach of 3.5 miles. LPFM launched in 2000, and Media Bridges applied for its license a year later. They were granted a permit 7 years later and didn't go on air until 2010. To date, WVQC has over 40 locally produced shows on topics ranging from the paranormal to issues in the gay communities to old-school hip-hop. Monty Rue is WVQC's version of Ed Lover, spinning throwbacks to days of Yo MTV Raps Today. I'm playing stuff you don't hear on commercial radio anymore, unless they have a blast from the past hour. I'm putting up Public Enemy, MC Light. I get callers that appreciate what I do, and think it rounds out Cincy's commercial hip-hop stations that are only going to play new music, he says. To read the rest of this article, including what legal necessities were required to get these applications permitted, and what niche markets LPFM fulfills, please follow links and read the rest of the article from the show notes. From TorrentFreak.com by Ernesto, dated May 3, 2012. Judge, an IP address doesn't identify a person or BitTorrent pirate. Mass BitTorrent lawsuits have been dragging on for more than 2 years in the U.S., involving more than 250,000 alleged downloaders. The copyright holders who start these cases generally provide nothing more than an IP address as evidence. Then they ask the courts to grant a subpoena, allowing them to ask Internet providers for the personal details of the alleged offenders. The problem, however, is that the person listed as the account holder is often not the person who is downloading the infringing material. Or put differently, an IP address is not a person. Previous judges who handled BitTorrent cases have made observations along these lines, but none has been detailed, as New York Magistrate Judge Gary Brown was in a recent order. In his recommendation order, the judge labels mass BitTorrent lawsuits a waste of judicial resources. For a variety of reasons, he recommends other judges to reject similar cases in the future. One of the arguments discussed in detail is the copyright holder's claim that IP addresses can identify the alleged infringers. According to Judge Brown, this claim is very weak. The assumption that the person who pays for Internet access at a given location is the same individual who allegedly downloaded a single sexually explicit film is tenuous, and one that has grown more so over time, he writes. An IP address provides only the location at which one of any number of computer devices may be deployed, much like a telephone number can be used for any number of telephones. Thus, it is no more likely that the subscriber to an IP address carried out a particular computer function. Here, the purported illegal downloading of a single pornographic film, than to say an individual who pays a telephone bill made a specific telephone call. The judge continues by arguing that having an IP address as evidence is even weaker than a telephone number, as the majority of U.S. homes have a wireless network nowadays. This means that many people, including complete strangers, if one has an open network, can use the same IP address simultaneously. While decades ago, home wireless networks were nearly non-existent, 61% of U.S. homes now have wireless access. As a result, a single IP address usually supports multiple computer devices, which, unlike traditional telephones, can be operated simultaneously by different individuals, Judge Brown writes. Different family members or even visitors could have performed the alleged downloads, unless the wireless router has been appropriately secured, and in some cases, even if it has been secured, neighbors or passerby could access the Internet using the IP address assigned to a particular subscriber and download the plaintiff's film. Judge Brown explains that the widespread use of wireless networks makes a significant difference in cases against file sharers. He refers to an old RIAA case of nearly a decade ago where the alleged infringer was located at a university on a wired connection offering hundreds to tracks in a shared folder. The judge points out that nowadays it is much harder to pinpoint specific infringers. Brown also cites various other judges who've made comments on the IP address issue in SBO Pictures Incorporated versus Does 1 through 3036, for example. The court noted, quote, by defying Doe defendants as ISP subscribers who were assigned certain IP addresses instead of actual internet users who allegedly engaged in infringing activity, plaintiffs' sought-after discovery has the potential to draw numerous innocent internet users into the litigation, placing a burden upon them that weighs against allowing the discovery as designed. End of quote. Judge Brown concludes that in these and other mass BitTorrent lawsuits, it is simply unknown whether the person linked to the IP address has anything to do with the alleged copyright infringements. Although the complaints state that the IP addresses are assigned to devices, and thus by discovering the individual associated with that IP address will reveal defendant's true identity, this is unlikely to be the case, he concludes. In other words, the copyright holders in these cases have wrongfully accused dozens, hundreds, and sometimes thousands of people. Aside from effectively shutting down all mass BitTorrent lawsuits in the Eastern District of New York, the order is a great reference for other judges dealing with similar cases. Suing BitTorrent users is fine, especially one at a time, but with proper evidence and not by abusing and misleading the courts. From torrentfreak.com, dated May 23, 2012, by Ernesto, Mega uploads Kim.com refuses to give up passwords. Mega Upload continues its legal battle both in the U.S. and New Zealand. This week, .com and his legal team were at Auckland's High Court to request a judicial review of the legality of the search warrants that were used to raid his Coatesville mansion in January. During the hearing, .com's lawyer, Paul Davison, demanded access to the data stored on the 135 computers and hard drives that were taken into custody. The lawyer argued that the data is needed to mount the proper defense, not only to fight for the extradition, but also to show that excessive police action was used during the raid. The raid was captured by CCTV data, which is stored on the computers in question. The FBI, however, is objecting to the data handover because some of the files are encrypted. Mega Upload's founder is refusing to hand over the passwords to those files before he's guaranteed access to the data himself, supervised by the court if needed. During the hearing, .com and his legal team also learned that the data stored on the computers has already been sent to the U.S. authorities. Previously, the court had offered assurances that this would not happen without prior warning. Davison responded to these revelations by saying that the process was off the rails and that the rights of Mega Upload's founder have been subverted. Talking to Radio New Zealand, .com's lawyer Ira Rothkin suggests foul play and alleges that the U.S. government is trying to get valuable evidence out of New Zealand to obstruct a successful defense. Our concerns are that the United States will have New Zealand take all the data and all the hard drives that have been confiscated and remove them from the New Zealand jurisdiction, essentially making it so the New Zealand judiciary cannot exercise New Zealand's views, New Zealand values, and fairness and due process, and bring it all over to the United States so that it cannot be used in an extradition hearing. Their hearings had an emotional effect on the Mega Upload founder when his lawyer recalled how .com was ripped from his family in January in a raid which may not have been legitimate. He had to wipe tears from his eyes. OutsideTheCourt.com commented on his emotional reaction. It's just remembering what happened to us, which I think was unfair and over the top. It just got to me. I'm just a human being, you know, he told reporters. Now that the hearings are over, it is up to Judge Winkleman to decide whether Mega Upload's founder can have access to his personal data and to decide on the possible judicial review into the legality of the search warrants. Meanwhile, the U.S. criminal case has gone relatively silent. Dotcom told Torrent Freak that his legal team is working hard on a reply to the indictment, where the mega conspiracy is accused of engaging in a racketeering conspiracy, conspiring to commit copyright infringement, conspiring to commit money laundering, and two substantive counts of criminal copyright infringement. Whether Mega Upload will have to defend itself in the U.S. is still uncertain, though. Last month, Judge O'Grady informed the FBI that a trial in the United States may never happen because it is impossible to serve a foreign company with criminal charges. So, editorial comment, that last paragraph is much more significant than it sounds. The case may not be prosecutable in the United States. What this implies, and this is a very heavy implication, is that a business in a foreign country that announces that it has discovered a way for independent artists to get paid by people downloading their music, regardless of whether or not the people who are doing the downloading are subscribers to the company provide the web server that is downloaded off of. Whether a company that makes that announcement can be raided by a foreign country, have all of its infrastructure taken by the FBI, wiping its business off of the face of the internet, regardless of whether or not the case actually gets to the courts in the United States, the business has been smashed. So, it is quite conceivable that the RIAA and MPAA companies could have bribed, either legally or illegally, FBI agents and other police forces to destroy a business in a foreign country illegally and effectively take a competitor to American music media establishment off the internet, out of fear that they might have found a business model that finally frees us of the RIAA. That's an important concept to remember. End of editorial comment. From EFF.org by Parker Higgins, dated May 21st, 2012, the Netherlands passes net neutrality legislation. New legislation in the Netherlands makes it the first country in Europe to establish a legal framework supporting net neutrality. In addition to the net neutrality provisions, the law contains language that restricts when ISPs can wiretap their users and limits the circumstances under which ISPs can cut off a subscriber's internet access altogether. The anti-wiretapping section of the new law specifies that ISPs may not use technologies like deep packet inspection, except under limited circumstances or with explicit consent from the ISP's customer, or to comply with a court order or other legislative provision. One Dutch ISP, KPN, came under fire last year for using DPI to determine whether its subscribers were using VoIP on mobile devices. The new law sets out an exhaustive list of six circumstances in which an ISP can disconnect or suspend the internet access of subscribers. These include termination at the request of the subscriber, non-payment by the subscriber, in case of deception, at the expiry of a fixed contract, force majeure, or if the ISP is required to terminate by law or a court order. In addition, the network neutrality provisions also permit blocking of an internet connection where necessary for the integrity and security of a network. The provisions are the Dutch government's implementation of the 2009 EU Telecoms Package Revision Framework. Article 1.3a of the Framework Directive states that EU member states may only adopt measures interfering with citizens' ability to access and use the internet in limited circumstances. In particular, measures may only be imposed if they are appropriate, proportionate, and necessary within a democratic society, and their implementation shall be subject to adequate procedural safeguards in conformity with the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms and General Principles of Community Law, including effective judicial protection and due process. To read the rest of this article, follow the links in the show notes. From EFF.org, dated April 20th, 2012, by Hani Fakhouri, a picture is worth a thousand words, including your location. At first blush, it seems obvious that a picture could reveal your location. A picture of you standing in front of the Golden Gate Bridge sensibly leads to the conclusion you're in the San Francisco Bay Area when the photo was taken. But now that smartphones are quickly supplanting traditional digital cameras, and even traditional cameras now have Wi-Fi built in, many more pictures are finding their way onto the web in places like Twitter, Flickr, Google+, and Tumblr. In a span of 10 days, popular photo social network Instagram added 10 million new users as a result of the release of its Android app and its acquisition by Facebook. And location data hidden in these quick and candid pictures, even when your location isn't as obvious as staying in front of the Golden Gate Bridge, is becoming another easy way for anyone, including law enforcement, to figure out where you are. Take the case of Wormer, a member of an anonymous offshoot called Cabin Crew, for example. According to the federal government, Wormer broke into a number of different law enforcement databases and obtained a wealth of sensitive information. In a Twitter post, Wormer provided a link to a website that contained the sensitive information as well as a picture of a woman posing with a sign taunting the authorities. Because the picture was taken with an iPhone 4, which contains a GPS device built in, the GPS coordinates of where the picture was taken was embedded into the picture's EXIF metadata. The FBI was able to use the EXIF data to determine that the picture was taken at a house in Wantirna, South Australia. The FBI tracked down other online references to Wormer, with one website containing the name Higinio Okoa. The feds took a look at Okoa's Facebook account, which detailed that his girlfriend was Australian. Combined with the EXIF metadata, the government believed they had corroborated the identity of Wormer as Okoa, and in turn arrested him. Even for photos taken with a smartphone and not embedded with GPS coordinates, for example, point-and-shoot SLR cameras that do not geotag, it's still possible for the police to get location information through EXIF metadata. You can upload a picture here and see the metadata stored in a picture for yourself. Contained within the metadata is the camera's serial number. Armed with that information, the police can easily scour the internet for other pictures tagged with the same serial number. In Australia, a man whose camera was stolen was able to track it down using stolencamerafinder.com because the thief had taken a picture with the camera and uploaded it to Flickr, where he had listed his address. But even if the thief's Flickr site didn't contain his address, police could have subpoenaed Flickr, like law enforcement have attempted to do with Twitter, for information concerning a user's temporary assigned IP address, as well as session times and logs, to eventually determine where a person uploaded a picture from, all of which can be used to piece together a snapshot, not only your movements, but, as in the case of Wormer, potentially your identity. In the United States, police are being trained about the broad investigative potential of this information. It might be tempting to say that the problem is overblown because some social media sites, including Facebook and Twitter, strip the metadata out of photos uploaded by their members, but not all do. TwitPic's default is to use the picture's location tag unless you opt out. Flickr gives you the option to hide a photo's EXIF data, but many casual photographers tempted by the rapid growth of photo sharing may not understand what EXIF data is and the implication of making it publicly available. The bigger problem is that courts have been expanding the police's right to search digital devices without a warrant under the search incident to arrest exception of the Fourth Amendment. While many of these cases involve warrantless searches of cell phones, there has been at least one case in California where the police used the search incident to arrest exception to search a juvenile's digital camera, and there are other reported incidents of photojournalists having their camera confiscated and searched when covering political protests and rallies. If the cops have the physical camera and thus the memory cards that store the photos, whatever scrubbing that happens when the photos upload to the web is no obstacle. So if you value your privacy, you should take steps to ensure the EXIF metadata on your pictures isn't an easy way for anyone on the internet to figure out your location. If you're using a smartphone to take pictures, disable geotagging from your pictures. If you're uploading your pictures to a website like Flickr or TwitPic that defaults to automatically include EXIF data and location information, take the steps to turn it off. And if you're using a traditional SLR or point-and-shoot camera that doesn't geotag but does contain a breadth of EXIF data, then make sure you scrub its metadata before you upload it on the internet. There are free online tools that will help you do precisely that. These simple steps will help ensure that the thousand words a picture describes doesn't include your location. Other headlines in the tech news? Urs Haeusel at Open Networking Summit in 2012. This is a link to the excellent perspective blog by AWS engineer James Hamilton, where he talks about Urs Haeusel's keynote talk at the Open Networking Summit. If you have a professional interest in computers, you really want to read this review, and or I should say listen to the audio or watch the video on YouTube for this talk. Google has proved that you can take the processing out of network switchers and vest it instead in a full web server, less slaving all the network devices to a centralized server for increased performance, scalability, and security. Important if you have a professional interest in these things. Why a cybersecurity bill will pass. This is an In These Times article about why the necessity, or I should say, why necessity will demand the passing of some form of cybersecurity bill, regardless of how utopians may view freedom and self-determination on the internet to be. News from rawstory.com, inthesetimes.com, spnyc.org, and allgov.com, and audio for Moment of Clarity number 139, used under arranged permission. News from torrentfreak.com, sasis.org.za, and eff.org, used under permission of the Creative Commons by attribution license. News sources retain their respective copyrights. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. This episode of Talk Geek to Me is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported License. This license allows commercial reuse of the work, as well as allowing you to modify the work, so long as you share alike the same rights you have received under this license. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.